Pharisees and Christianese. Having read the Bible, I increasingly found in my late teens that I had been raised to be the modern Christian equivalent of the Pharisees. Those people who Jesus sparred with so much in the New Testament, the ones who wanted Jesus Christ dead. I was a teenage Pharisee. It was a vile thing to know. I could see that I was one of those superficially pious people. Kids at school sometimes judged me a Pharisee, though they didn't call it that, and I knew deep down that they were right. They saw me not going out to movies, not attending high school dances or celebrating Christmas and Halloween. I didn't talk normally like they did, having an extensive list of things I wouldn't say. They knew there was no alcohol in our house. And rather than being impressed by how virtuous we seemed, how adherent to an elevated standard of decency, they saw through it all, saw our true motives, and judged us to be religious show-offs, people who were doing things to try to be better than everyone, people who were kind of cold and weird and mean inside, but outwardly rather polite, certainly never swearing, but not being forgiving, loving, warm, tolerant, patient, comfortable, and inviting to be around either, because of that weird religious thing we had going on, which made us creepy. They were no fools. That's exactly what was going on. A weird religious thing. And God made it manifest in time by letting everything we built fall down, by confusing our languages so we couldn't even agree what anything was even called anymore in building our Tower of Bible. I knew that Jesus, not meeting people, was supposed to be my example for how I ought to live. I was supposed to be and do good, like Jesus. But the meeting people were very frequently counting on me to not act like Jesus, or overtly telling me to quit it. I'd read the Gospels. I had a pretty clear idea of who he was. And he wasn't just one thing. And he was difficult a lot of the time. I can't imagine he ever faked a plastic smile, said he was fine when he wasn't, or was fake nice to someone he was annoyed with. There was nothing plastic about Jesus. I was talking with Ruth the other day, and she said how dumb she always found it when church passion or Easter plays or movies or whatever depicted Jesus as what she calls Valium Jesus, with the blank face, even when being tortured and killed. Impassive, maybe even smiling a bit sadly. I always tend to call that depiction of him Stoner Jesus, you know? People are afraid to imagine him with emotion, so he's just kinda blank. But that's not right. The scriptures say he cried. They have him giving a number of challenging, wild, crazy-sounding speeches. They have him being scary enough to clear an entire marketplace worth of people and animals out of the temple at Jerusalem. They have him being sorrowful and being betrayed. And they have him expressing a lot of disappointment and frustration generally. Often in the Gospels, Jesus is talking to Pharisees. One thing that was pretty clear to me is that he treated Pharisees differently from how he treated anyone else. Focused on them repeatedly, was harsher both to and about them in public. No attempt to be quiet, gentle, kind, or forgiving to those guys. Now, what was that all about? Jesus of Nazareth has become nowadays for many people little more than the patron saint of serenity and meek, mild tolerance and kindness. Gentle Jesus, meek and mild, is how a lot of people need to see him. Someone who said not to judge, who criticized no one, and wanted us to be nice to everyone. The God of nice. A person who'd never make anyone reconsider anything. I think this weird view of the man Jesus all comes back to that control thing. If Jesus of Nazareth was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief today, conventional modern Christian culture would tell him to cheer up, to rejoice, to get Prozac, to think on whatever things are good, etc. Fake a smile, get singing. If he was angry or frustrated or impatient, he'd be once again told that he'd lost control of his holiness and to go fix it. A stiff regimen of church activities, helpful books, songs, and propaganda would no doubt have been prescribed. Because that darker emotional stuff's gotta be controlled, right? You can't just feel those feelings. But we know that Jesus of Nazareth wept and shouted, groaned with frustration, got angry and threw stuff, was harsh or rude with certain people, got impatient and outraged and stuff like that. And he called people rude names, which many Christians have assured me somehow does not count as name-calling. But we were told that Jesus was the Christ, God become human, to show us how it ought to be done. then wouldn't that mean either A, Jesus wasn't perfect and broke brethren rules, or B, that all that emotional stuff didn't make him imperfect, though it doesn't sound terribly like controlling one's emotions? As I've written before, this Gospels conundrum has folks scrambling to argue that Jesus didn't really get angry or frustrated, or certainly didn't ever lose his temper with anything, that his calling the Pharisees a bunch of names did not count as name-calling, that his questioning their parentage wasn't rude, or that because he was God, that this made wrath one of the many things that only he could do, but that we, of course, can't. So we shouldn't try to be like him, because we can't. Note that the latter view tidily removes the Christ from serving as any kind of role model for Christians, that it replaces a Messiah with a minister, a crucified pariah with a certified pastor. The fact is, by all accounts, Jesus was continually challenging to most people, and there was one group he seemed to keep coming back to over and over again. It wasn't the half-Jewish Samaritans, even made one the star of a story. He didn't rant and rave against the Romans who occupied Israel at that point. He even praised the faith of a Roman soldier, contrasted the soldier with how faithless he felt the Jews were. He didn't rant about drunkenness and adultery, didn't speak out and take a clear stance against gay people, didn't publicly denounce people who were shady with money. He didn't rail against the government. It wasn't even the Sadducees as much who were the targets of his ire. It was the Pharisees, the Jewish religious elite, at whom he took aim most often. They got both barrels over and over again. There is no parable of the good Pharisee, and Saul of Tarsus had to stop being one and become a new person entirely with a new name before God got any use out of him. Jesus goes into Jerusalem and in public places and in synagogues, quite unprovoked, warns the regular folk not to be like the Pharisees, that they'd have to do better than the Pharisees, that their faith, their relationship with God, had to run deeper than that. And he uses a word for them that he just might have been the first person to ever use in quite that way. It's the word that in English is translated hypocrite, though we use it differently than Jesus did. In Greek, it's Hippocrates. Jesus is recorded using this word no fewer than 17 times. No one in the Bible uses this word but Jesus. The KJV contains the word hypocrites in the Old Testament, but it's not the same word. That Hebrew word means obscene or godless. Hippocrates means actor, literally someone performing under a mask, someone fake, lacking sincerity and substance, plastic, putting on a show for the world, inauthentic, not revealing his or her true nature and personality, presenting an invented, idealized nature and self as if it were the real one, giving insincere emotional and social responses rather than genuine ones. It looks very like no one in human history is recorded using this word for any purpose other than to speak about literal, theatrical performers, until Jesus. In Matthew chapter 23, Jesus is recorded saying about the Pharisees, "Everything they do is done for people to see." He is depicted earlier in Matthew 6, warning his disciples, "Take care not to do your good deeds publicly or before men in order to be seen by them." He was trying to teach a different, better way, a way that wasn't religious and had to do with the kingdom of heaven rather than human systems. And the first thing that's got to go if you're serving heaven rather than human beings? Giving thought to how to gain their notice and approval, limiting your choices in case people might not understand and they might fail to think well of you. I think it's safe to say that we need to rethink our carefully posed I'm praying and I'm reading the Bible and I'm feeding hungry children and I'm teaching Christians action photographs and videos on the internet and announcing on social media that we're doing these things and claiming it is our right to express or show off our piety and Christianity in so doing. That we're just humbly seeking to inspire others by being a good testimony to our own piety. I think it's safe to say that along with whitewashed sepulchres, bulls washed only on the outside but dirty inside, and offspring of vipers, that this word Hippocrates shows what Jesus' problem with Pharisees was and how to be one today. Backstabbing, but pious-seeming fakers, showing off their religious activities to an audience. For status, to hold on to an image of heightened decency, what Dallas Willard calls the lure of religious honors. The Pharisees had people literally blow trumpets in front of them when they were going to the synagogue to pray. We said grace audibly as a group in a McDonald's rather than each thanking God for his Big Mac discreetly, to be a good testimony. The Pharisees marked up their faces to indicate they were fasting from food. We fasted from television and music all year long, every year, and everyone knew it. We were terrified to walk past the front of a movie theater for fear someone might think we'd been inside it. The Pharisees made a show of donating money to charity. We've got magnets on our fridges and eye-catching t-shirts and bumper stickers, which leave no one in any doubt about the fact that we support a cause financially. It's a hard habit to break. Step one is becoming the sort of person who is no longer impressed with it, who is no longer accustomed to viewing it as normal and proper and good. You can never control it with rules, of course. You have to do something else instead is all. Follow a different path. Take your heart out of what is mainly a performance, so the lack of applause won't be able to hurt you any more than the presence of it will be able to make you feel smug. Do stuff for God only, and see how you like that. Pursue discretion about spiritual intimacy, and practice private good. Think about how you use the internet and social media. See how deep the satisfaction you might get out of anything that is self-promotion as to Christian things really goes. See if maybe you want something deeper. Notice how you feel when you're getting likes and supportive comments for religious activity you've shared online. Notice what's going on in your heart regarding it until you don't feel so into it anymore. Until you don't like yourself when you're merely liking likes for people liking Christian stuff. And then do something different. See what that's like. Quietly collect pledges to do a marathon run to save money for cystic fibrosis research. Then do the run. And don't tell anyone. Don't breathe a word of it online. Don't spend the year afterward wearing a shirt that says, "I ran for cystic fibrosis." Do it, but don't announce it. Don't raise awareness of yourself and what you're doing and what kind of an awesome person you are to be humbled to take part in it. Just do it. To get the money off to the people. Jesus did not raise awareness of the plight of sick people. Everyone knows it sucks to be sick. He either walked by them or he helped them. And when he healed them, he told them quite often not to tell anyone what he'd done. Who knows how many people Jesus healed or helped who told no one and never made it into the Bible. So try making a difference without raising awareness of you. Try it, not in order to follow a rule that says that advertising your charitable efforts is bad or wrong. Try it, and see what you then know about yourself. See if there's something special in it. I can't tell you. It's a you thing. When you're at the cash in Walmart and they ask you if you'd like to donate money to a children's charity and you say yes, refuse the colorful little paper they're going to get you to write your name on to post it up on the wall to show how many donations they've collected and that you did one. Give the money, but deny Walmart and you any wall-posted recognition, or use amusing pseudonyms. You can probably guess which one I, Mr. W. Sepulcher, prefer to use. I can only tell you what worked for me. For me, every Christian thing I did, I was doing primarily because it had been made a rule. A rule I was afraid of losing the trust and respect of my church culture if I broke. So the first thing I really seemed to have to do was break that pious acts rule until it wasn't a rule anymore in my heart. I didn't make a new rule requiring me to break that people-pleasing rule. I just faced my fear. I just didn't do meeting things. It wasn't easy. In fact, my culture was a far bigger thing than I was in my life, certainly a far bigger thing than God was. So God simply took the trust and respect of my church culture away from me, and that did the trick. This finally freed me to do things because I wanted to do them for God, and not because I was afraid of not doing them and worried about the scorn of brethren people. I don't know if he'll do that with you. I don't know if you need to worry about all that or not. Performance isn't bad. It's an art. It's a creative, expressive endeavor. If you're singing a song or acting in a play or doing a dance routine or scoring goals for an audience's approval, do that. Because it's why you're doing it and there's purity in that. It's people you're trying to touch. There might even be a benefit in competition. When it comes to spirituality and a walk with God and being transformed into the image of Christ, though, very different, because then it's God who you're trying to touch, and competition really doesn't belong. So maybe try both audiences, to see the difference, God and men. Because it's important. Jesus never seemed to leave Pharisees alone, actually walked into Jerusalem on a few occasions and went into the temple or the synagogue and provoked an argument with the Pharisees, waited until they showed up before commencing in one particular case, ignored his brother's advice to avoid the Pharisees for his own safety and the good of his reputation. Why treat Pharisees differently than he was treating anyone else? Why not try to teach them? Why condemn rather than forgive them? The Christ's Complaint. I don't think it's hard to tell what Jesus' problem was with Pharisees, whose name means the separated ones, the ones who drew apart from the rest of Jewish society to do religion right. For one thing, they were malicious. If they couldn't get you arrested by trapping you in rhetoric and logic, they'd incite mobs to pick up rocks or throw you off things. It's clear that Jesus took exception to their venomous scheming and backbiting and treachery in calling them offspring of vipers. Would you rather be called a son of a female canine or a son of a snake? He asked them, "Why do you seek to kill me?" when they weren't admitting it, even though they really were looking to have him executed. This is very in keeping with the Old Testament, which speaks out against people who are underhanded, whose mouths are open pits, who oppress the vulnerable, who delight in the downfall of others, who lay nets for other people's feet, and whose own feet are quick to shed blood. The Old Testament has many grim warriors who slew many people, but we don't read of them using sneaky tricks or stabbing anyone in the back. We don't have a bunch of stories about biblical patriarchs gaining power through character assassination and political intrigue. But there was something else besides the venomous malice of the separated ones. Besides the sons of vipers thing, Jesus uses the imagery of a tomb which is full of rotting bodies inside but is painted gleaming white outside, along with the image of a bowl which is polished up bright and clean around the outside rim but left filthy inside where you'd pour your Cheerios. This shows that he's looking on their hearts rather than their lifestyles. He's seeing people who are extremely pious-looking in their lifestyles and habits, but inside, they are twisted, decaying, and dark. This was the root of the malice, the reason for the backstabbing. They were dangerous because they needed to look pious no matter what it took. If they were standing behind you and you were doing anything that made you look good, they were apt to stick a knife in to remove a competitor and better their status, or look to do the same to your reputation. Our Lord's only comment on the Pharisees' clothes is to disdain their attempts to look religious, and he also disdains their need to sit in a special seat of honor in the synagogues. I think, just like today, in Jesus' time, there were a whole lot of regular folks who weren't terribly religious or terribly depraved either, but who looked to the Pharisees and said, "We regular guys do stuff we're not really supposed to. We're certainly not living quite how we should. If we lived how we were supposed to, we'd be living like the Pharisees. They're hardcore. Those guys are doing it right." And Jesus wanted to warn everyone who would listen that those guys were not doing it right, though they were certainly hardcore and hard-hearted. People were supposed to get well inside and get in touch with God and get the dented up, twisted, rusting parts of their psyches dealt with. And they weren't ever going to succeed at that by letting Pharisees be the religious ones for them, nor by imitating those guys and their focus on how upstanding they looked and what others thought, rather than upon what was really good and would actually work. Jesus was there, walking the walk, telling the truth, helping people out, forgiving everyone, believing in people's willingness to turn around and follow him, changing the world and filling it up with virtue and worth. The Pharisees, by contrast, were going around looking religious and leaping at the chance to be the punishers of people caught looking less religious than they. The act of leaping to judge others makes clear that need to seem the dominant, empowered, superior person. They were worrying about being publicly seen to be giving money to charity, yearning to be famous for going to synagogue and praying a lot, and looking pious and stoning people and so on. I think the response of Jesus to this can only be characterized as disgusted if his choice of imagery is any indication. Poisonous snakes, tombs filled with putrefaction, bowls smeared with filth inside. So the Pharisees, publicly shown up by Jesus, plotted to get him killed, those sons of vipers. Those vindictive, censoring, repressing, image-conscious hearts didn't get light shone into them and truth spoken into them either. They remained dark, twisted, scheming, and mean. They worked to get rid of Jesus, to silence his ideas. For good, they thought. Didn't quite work out that way.